You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Yeah, it's for all New Zealand's 1.123 million children. That's about a quarter of the population. It's divided into six overarching categories. I could summarise them. One is that children and young people should feel loved, safe and nurtured. That's the first one. Secondly, they have what they need. We're talking about child poverty and those sorts of things there. Happy and healthy. Number three, we're looking at health issues in particular. Number four, are learning and developing. That covers, I guess, educational issues. Five, are accepted, respected and connected. That's talking about respecting culture, identity and background. And number six, are involved and empowered. That is, that they are actively engaged in their local community and making a meaningful contribution. I think those six headings are great. Now, underneath that, underneath each of the six, there's a work and action program, and 75 separate plans are in place to give life to those six big headings.
So it's a very overarching strategy.
You are exactly right, and it's a good word for it. It is overarching, and it's what we've never had. We've had lots of individual initiatives for children and young people over the years, but there's never been a comprehensive, as you put it, overarching policy approach.
And why do you think that's important?
Forward.
Yeah, to have sort of such a broad approach rather than, you know, making changes in sort of different areas of people's lives.
Well, I can tell you why it's important from the benefit of hindsight. For 30 years, we haven't had it. And children, particularly at the margins, have languished and disadvantage has got greater. And I think unless we focus on children as a whole and look at what's going on across the board, we dropped the ball and did drop the ball in New Zealand over the last 30 years at least of not having an overarching policy and gaps between those who succeeded and those who didn't, those with good outcomes and those with bad outcomes. Those gaps got greater and greater. And that ought to concern all New Zealand. We changed significantly as a country over the last 30 years. And we now have 10% of our children, that is two Eden Parks full worth of children, really in chronic disadvantage. A further 20% who are struggling. 70% do really well. But that 70-20-10 holds good whether you measure it in health or education or youth justice. Child poverty right across the board, that 70-20-10 is a good summary of what's going on. And why we need an overarching policy is to ensure that all children benefit, not just those in the top 70%.
So what was the process of creating this strategy? Has it been sort of a long time coming? And were young people involved? How was this created?
Well, the short answer to your questions are yes, yes and yes. Actually, it all originated from the child poverty reduction legislation, because part of that act amended what was called the Vulnerable Children's Act and replaced it with the Children's Act. And front and centre in that new Children's Act was the obligation on the government of the day, and this is a continuing obligation, every 3 years to produce a child and youth wellbeing strategy. First ever. I do think it's world leading. Very few countries have tried this. We couldn't hardly find any that had a similar whole-of-country strategy for children. And what's more, the legislation made it an obligation for the government to consult with children and young people before embarking on the strategy and with Māori. So there was, for the first time ever, 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 ever in New Zealand, a statutory obligation, a lawful duty to consult with children and young people. And about 6,500 were consulted with. We helped that consultation. They and their views significantly informed and changed the thinking on the wellbeing strategy.
Now, were these 6,000 or so children from a particular group of people, or was it, again, overarching across all children across New Zealand?
We tried to get as wide a cross-section as we could, from a variety of secondary and primary schools, rural, urban, single-sex, co-ed, And particularly, we wanted to hear from children and young people who were migrants, refugees, disabled, LGBTQI, communities that often aren't heard of. So it was a pretty actually mammoth and comprehensive effort, with a particular focus on those who are the most marginalised. And, you know, what was interesting is the initial thinking by the adults had five, not six, domains, and they were all couched in what you might call the absence of negatives, such as freedom from abuse and neglect, freedom from poverty. Children and young people put it upside down. They said what's important is the presence of positives. So instead of abuse and neglect, they said we want to feel loved, safe, nurtured. We don't want to be free from poverty. We want to have what we need. So the whole thrust of the strategy, and you might just say it's words, but it's more than that, came from sort of a deficit mentality, measuring the absences, to a positive, constructive approach, saying this is what we want for our children. That's what children said time and time again. They said we want to be loved and nurtured at home. We want to have warm, dry homes. We want to enjoy school, do well at school, have good friends, and have our culture recognised and our identity valued.
And now I was just wondering how you thought the strategy will be implemented practically. How will parents and young people themselves see changes happening in their day-to-day lives?
Great question, because it's no point just talking in the abstract unless we can see measurable change. There are a number of indicators. Some of them are still being formulated, as I understand it. And we'll want to see improvement, for instance, in NCEA achievement. We'll want to see improvement in rheumatic fever, for instance. I'm just talking about some indicators that are useful. We want to see child poverty numbers coming down. We'll want to see youth offending numbers coming down, because really the tentacles of disadvantage and child poverty reach into so many areas of a child's life. So part of the strategy is rigorous measurement on a number of indicators to show that there is change for the better. And boy, do we need it, especially for that 10 and 20%.
Now, I'd just like to move on to the call for anti-bullying programs that you made over the weekend. Why have you made this call?
Bullying is an insidious and destructive and damaging phenomenon. And in terms of reported bullying in schools, we lead the world. I mean, that is an utter disgrace for New Zealand. We're better than that. That's not how we want to live in our communities. Mind you, we should say it's part of a wider issue in context. We have high rates of family partner violence, family violence, abuse and neglect, and I guess the suicide is to some extent connected with it all. So the call that I've made is that for 4 to 5 years we've had a bullying prevention action group based in Wellington, cross-government. They've got some useful and helpful bullying prevention guidelines. But too much has been left to the schools, therefore, to put that into practice. And ERO recently, the Educational Review Office, said as many as 20% of our schools have a very limited commitment to a bullying-free environment. There's about 35% of schools who are doing a good job and working really hard to a committed bullying-free culture. But the call that I made was to say no more can we leave it up to well-meaning boards of trustees. We've got to make this obligatory, mandatory, and yes, the C word, compulsory. They have to demonstrate that they've got an evidence-based good bullying plan in place, and it's measurable, and we can see the numbers coming down, and we can't just leave it anymore to boards of trustees and trust them to put that program in place. Too many schools haven't got it, and the time's come to make it mandatory.
And now you said, I mean, obviously bullying is not a good thing. It's a horrible thing to experience. It's a horrible thing to have going on in schools, and for New Zealand to be the highest in the world with bullying rates in schools, it's very disappointing and sad. Why do you think the Board of Trustees, who I would say, you know, if majority maybe of Board of Trustees members are parents, why isn't anybody doing anything about it or introducing anti-bullying programs if it is such a horrible issue?
Well, it's on everybody's radar. I think it's every parent's, in a sense, nightmare to have children being bullied or bully themselves. Both ways, we need to step in and get some real help. My sense is that with the change in changeover in board personnel and the like, I think some momentum is lost. It's a very good question that you ask, and it saddens me, I think, that some schools, for reasons that are hard to actually understand, don't have the best policies and practices in place. And that's why I'm saying it's got to change. It's a very significant question as to why that might not be happening. I wonder if we take it seriously enough. I've got to say that. I wonder if we...
It's more sort of a just toughen up kind of...
Yeah, a toughen up, or boys will be boys, or girls will be girls, yeah. Or teenagers will be teenagers, and is it really that bad? I think we underestimate the insidious effects, the long-term damage, and of course, you cannot have this discussion without saying the rise in the use of social media has made persistent anonymised bullying much easier. I think it flows over into the face-to-face. I mean, you heard some of the allegations that were made in an Auckland secondary school where a boy who was struggling, a group of other boys said, well, why don't you take your own life so we can, quote, piss on your grave, end quote. I mean, that is deeply disturbing. But this is not just casual schoolyard banter we're talking about. This is profound and deep and enduring. And perhaps parents themselves don't want to keep up with technology and underestimate what's really going on.
And you can't leave that either being bullied or being a bully at home. You can just get on your phone and, you know, continue to experience it outside of school any hour of the day. Which,
that's exactly right.
As like, I suppose parents haven't experienced that themselves, and maybe that's why I'm, yeah.
Yeah, that may be what. We know that the best examples we can point to are schools that have co-designed with senior staff, boards of trustees and students, co-designed a program where there is no shame or stigma in reporting bullying. People know that it will be dealt with and confronted and resolved. There'll be help for the bullied and the bully. And there's a school-wide zero-tolerance culture to bullying. That we know, when that's in place, it's a different culture, and schools prosper and kids really enjoy being there. But our office, we've had too many instances of where kids have been deeply affected by enduring bullying, and it can scar for life.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.